Welcome to Food Safety, The Fact. Hi everyone, I'm Dawn Schaefer and I'm your host for Food Safety, The Fact, a series of food safety podcasts which analyse topics and issues relevant to food manufacturing and present the facts in an easy to understand way. Over the series, our expert guests will share their knowledge and insights into this increasingly important topic. This new food safety series of podcasts is going to start off by taking a closer look at food safety culture, what it is, what it means for organisations working in the sector, how to meet BRCGS Global Standard Food Safety Issue 8 food safety culture requirements, and just for info, we're going to refer to BRCGS as BRC. And we'll give an insight into 4C culture models that can be used to understand and improve your food safety culture. As part of the series, we'll be giving away a free tool that will allow you to measure your food safety culture and implement a food safety improvement programme. Details of the free tool and how to access it will be given at the end of the podcast. Throughout the podcast, you'll hear some startling facts about food safety and its potential impact from our resident expert, Peter Henry. Here he is with a few facts to get us started.
An estimated 600 million, almost 1 in 10 people in the world, fall ill after eating contaminated food. And 420,000 die every year, resulting in the loss of 33 million healthy life years. The largest ever listeria outbreak in known history occurred in South Africa in 2017, where there were 216 deaths. Celia Marsh, 42, allegedly died having a reaction to a flatbread sandwich sold by a food chain that was supposed to be dairy-free.
So in this, our first of our podcasts, we're going to explore the facts and fiction and mull the myths and truths of food safety culture. So what is food safety culture? Why is it important? Why should food manufacturers be interested and what should they be doing? And importantly, what should they not? To chew the fat on these and other food safety culture issues, I'm joined by John Husband. John's a director at Titrain, one of the UK's leading food manufacturing focused training providers, and there's not much he doesn't know about food safety culture. In fact, Titrain, alongside the University of Sunderland, developed Enlighten, one of the world's first food safety culture models designed to help manufacturers understand where their organisation stands in terms of food safety culture. John's also a BRC approved principal trainer and has a really diverse background over his 30 years experience in helping companies in the food industry and the offshore petrochemicals industry. From implementing management systems, process change management and training, including BRCGS Global Standards Food Safety, ISO 9001, ISO 14001 and FSC Chain of Custody Management Systems, he's done the lot food industry wise. John was one of the first BRC approved training providers and in 2010 became an approved principal training partner. So, he sounds like just the man to ask about food safety culture and what it all means for the sector. John, welcome. So, can you start at the beginning? What is food safety culture and what does it mean?
Well, Dawn, before I explain what food safety culture is, I think it would be helpful to understand how food safety culture fits into food safety quality management systems. To do that, we need to understand how quality management systems have evolved and where they started from. And I'd like to start off by asking you, do you know where food safety management systems started?
I don't know.
No.
So tell me how it all began. I assume I know nothing.
Right, no problem. So the first known standards were instigated by the government during World War One to resolve reliability issues of ammunition being used. And the reason being, there was a large percentage of ammunition shells sent to the front were duds and did not explode on impact. So this probably had a major impact on the outcome of the Battle of the Somme, where British Army suffered huge casualties. Following on from that, the Ministry of Defence created a number of standards. And what they did is they created the standards and they employed a number of inspectors to actually visit sites and factories to actually oversee the manufacture of machinery, equipment and ammunition. Now that was a great start, but the problem with the DEF standards as they were known, they were very much based on quality control principles. And when I talk about quality control principles, what I'm actually talking about is we set a specification, we carry out a number of inspections, and then we inspect the product before it leaves the actual factory. And that was great as a starting point. But then in the 50s, there was a gentleman called Edward Deming, and he was an American quality guru and statistician. And what he actually said was, you can't inspect quality into a product. And to support this, what he actually did is he did a number of studies. So he went into a number of different manufacturing plants. And what he did is he took components and he put defects in those components. And then he sent those components down the line and he measured how many of those components were actually identified. Now, what you need to remember is that these production lines will have had highly skilled quality technicians, and their main job was to carry out the inspections. Do you know what percentage of inspections were actually missed?
No.
14% of all defects that went down were actually missed.
Wow.
So from that, that's when he came up with this term, you can't inspect quality into the product. And when we talk about that, I often wonder and think about food companies and how many of us are actually inspecting labels prior to a production run, and we've got one person inspecting those labels. What's the likelihood that somebody is going to get the wrong label or mess up? So that was the start. From then, we then moved into the 70s, where we actually saw much more sort of quality management systems. And when I talk about quality management systems, what we're talking about is systems that comprise of things like a manual, procedures, work instructions. And also, individuals were made responsible for their individual activities and workmanship at each stage of the process. So what we weren't doing is we weren't just relying on somebody carrying out an inspection, we were making everybody in the line responsible. We then had the introduction of standards like BS 5750, which led on to ISO 9000 series. And of course, in 1998, we have the first BRC global standard for food safety. By the time we get to the mid-2000s, we can now see all of the major standards moving towards risk assessment and process approach. Now, there will be some of our listeners listening in saying, but food standards already had risk assessment because most food standards are based on HACCP. But what I would also say, since we've got HACCP, we've also introduced things like TASUP, vulnerability assessment, and food defence risk assessment. So the actual amount of risk assessment has actually increased as we've gone along. So if we take where we are now, we're now at the stage where we have highly developed food safety quality management systems, really good systems. But what the standards bodies are now realising is that within the current food safety quality management standards, they don't actually address the emotional and psychological effect that people and groups have on food safety. And in other words, I would say food safety culture. So what we are now seeing is the BRC including auditable requirements in version 8 of the standard covering food safety culture to address this. Now we understand the development of food safety management systems and where food safety culture has come from, we can now look at your original question. So I think we originally started out by saying, what is food safety culture? Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to do is start off by explaining the difference between food safety culture and food safety management systems. And the way I like to explain this, if I'm actually delivering training, is it's like a brick wall. If we take a brick wall, we have individual bricks. And what we can do is we can take those bricks, and each one of those bricks could be a different part of a food safety management system. Example being hazard plan, pest control, vulnerability assessment, food defence, environmental monitoring. If I stack all of those bricks up and stand behind, it would be very easy to push those bricks over. So what I now need is, I now need the cement in between the bricks to hold it all together. And that is what the food safety culture is. It's the cement between the bricks to stop it falling over. Now, we can take it one stage further. And what I'd like to do is another example of how I actually explain sort of food safety culture. And this is around a school. Now, if you've got young children and they go to a school, they go to a primary school, you would like to think that the person within that school who sets the culture is actually the headmaster. And what he does is he cascades that down to head of departments, who cascade it down to teachers, who then cascade it down to the classroom. Now, I'd like to take everybody back to when they were 8 years old. I know that's difficult when you're my age, but there you go. So we're 8 years old, we're in a class, and our teacher gives us an activity to do. And after he's given us the activity, he tells the class that he needs to go away and do something else. So he leaves those 8-year-olds in the classroom. And the question I would have is, how long before that group of 8-year-olds start playing or mucking about? And quite often you'll have individuals that will actually start that. So when we look at that scenario, what we can actually do, we can actually relate that back to a manufacturing unit. And what we can say is that there are two types of culture within an organisation. The first is the formal culture, which is set by the directors and senior managers and is cascaded down. And the second is the informal culture, which are the individuals and groups of people. And you can quite often see the informal culture if you go into a canteen at dinner time. You will have the same people sat round the same table, possibly talking, playing cards. And I bet you've got one or two people within that group who control how that group actually operates and perform.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, I mean, basically what you're saying is we're great at systems. There are lots of systems in place. But actually, if you have some individuals working within any organisation who maybe don't respond to the systems and or don't behave in an appropriate way, they can almost render those great systems and checks redundant, because
yes,
they're setting a culture where people may ignore those checks and balances.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we need to think about is that, you know, we'll have people listening in today thinking about their own culture within their own organisation. And what they seriously need to think about is, how are they going to measure the formal culture and how it's been implemented, and how are they going to actually sort of measure the informal culture that might be having a detrimental effect on the formal culture?
Absolutely. So I guess there's a risk, isn't there, of thinking, well, if you're a director or if you are a managing director and quite far up the management chain, you think, well, I've got my systems, I've got my checks and balances, so that's fine. I'm setting a great culture. I'm telling people what to do and what we should think and believe. This is my vision and this is my beliefs. And this is how we're going to operate. And they just assume that's happening.
They do. They do. And I think what we need to remember is, it doesn't matter which company you go into, but every company has a culture. And what we need to do as part of the BRC standard is determine, have we got a positive culture or have we actually got a negative culture? And where we possibly have a negative culture, then we need to put some sort of improvement programs in place that will actually help that. And quite often, when you look at those sort of cultures, it boils down to the sort of the customs and the values and the beliefs that you have within the organisation.
So that's a really interesting set of words, customs, values, beliefs. They're big, impactful words. I mean, can you tell me a little bit more about what those things actually mean in this context?
Yeah, and I mean, it's absolutely key to food safety culture. If people want to try and improve or move forward, they need to understand what is meant by customs, values and beliefs. Customs is fairly easy. Underneath customs, you've got traditions and rituals. So I'm going to give you two examples. If we talk about tradition, then that is something, and an example could be a pizza manufacturer. And for many, many years within that pizza manufacturer, the chef or the cook who's cooked the pizzas has always used a wooden paddle to actually put pizzas into the oven and take them out. Because of food safety standards, we don't like wood in a manufacturing area. We now want him to use a metal paddle. Trying to get somebody to change from that is very, very difficult. And then on the ritual side, it's what we've already said. It's where people have their own rituals, and it might be a case of people going to the canteen and sitting together. A simple one could be within an office environment. You've got four people in an office, they all go and have lunch together, and then all of a sudden you get a new supervisor who says, wait a minute, we're going to split. I want two of you to go at 12 o'clock and two of you to go at 1 o'clock. That is going to cause huge problems. So understanding the different traditions within your business and the different rituals will help you understand the food safety culture within there.
Okay.
The next one, I personally think, is probably one of the stronger of the three, and it is values. And the easiest way to think of values is values are commonly held informal standards. So let's just repeat that. Commonly held informal standards. So they're not written down, but they are standards that everybody knows.
Okay.
And the problem with that is that it is how you conduct yourself and other people react and reward you against those standards. So as an example, if I have a supervisor, and the only time he ever gives me praise or asks me or encourages me is with regards to production targets, then I am going to focus in on those and maybe not on the food safety side.
I understand, okay.
So it becomes really important, and it's how people perceive you and the way that you actually conduct yourself. And another very simple one is, I start a new company, I go in, I'm working very hard, and then all of a sudden somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, John, what you need to do is slow down, because if we get all of this production done, then there's going to be no overtime. Now, I'm sat there as a new employee, am I going to meet my formal culture, my manager and supervisor, or am I now going to meet my peer group, the people I'm going to sit in? Because if I don't meet their requirements, I'm probably going to be ignored at best and bullied at worst. Mm-hmm. So that's what we mean about values. Does that make sense?
It does, and it's different people's different priorities is what you're saying. So people come at things from a different perspective. The management will have different priorities.
Yes.
And the workforce will have different priorities. And it's which one do you as an individual follow? But equally, how does someone measure that? How does someone measure how that's playing out within the organisation?
Yep. And quite often, those values and standards will be generated by individuals within a group. They will actually lead what other people do.
The influencers.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The people that have that cultural influence within an organization.
So this is when you come to actually putting together sort of culture improvement programs, then you really need to understand the different groups and informal groups within the office within the manufacturing and understand who is actually controlling what, and so you can influence it. The last one is beliefs, and these are basically created and communicated by individuals and groups, and they believe it is their right. And you know, it might be totally outside of what the company wants to do, but they genuinely feel that they should be treated or they have a right. And they set these standards and then they impose them and communicate them to others. Now, a great example of this is new employees.
Okay.
If you bring a new employee into the company, and you put him with a group of people, they will automatically impose their standards, their values, and their beliefs on top of them. And this is why it is very important. If you're bringing somebody into the company, you need a strong induction program.
Okay.
So you can make people very much aware of the sort of the policies, the procedures, the beliefs, and the values that you want them to actually adhere to, rather than the informal culture. And I think a lot of people get that wrong. You know, we go into companies and we see induction programs and the sort of half hour read through, sign this bit of paper, and then they get passed on. And unfortunately, they get passed on to groups who are then going to influence them greatly. So hopefully that's explained a little bit more what we mean by customs, values, and beliefs.
It really has. And it's, when you talk about it, it's actually, it makes perfect sense, and it's common sense, really. Exactly what you're saying is, of course, the people that are working on the floor, there are more of them in volume, and so clearly they're going to have an influence, and they're the people doing the work on a day-to-day basis, whereas the management are probably not on the floor every day, and won't have the same influence with the peer group.
Yeah.
But that's the, if you like, the sticky part. That's the bit where it can go badly wrong.
Yeah.
And can have a real detrimental effect on the whole organisation.
But from what you're saying there, a number of the companies we go into and we assist with food safety culture, sometimes what comes out of it is that managers and supervisors, probably more managers, need to spend more time actually in the production areas and become much more accessible and see what's going on and things like that. Because, you know, they have this perceived idea of what's going on, but the reality quite often is actually different, isn't it?
Very different, very different. And to managers, I mean, we talked about people's different priorities and different perspectives and what's important to them, and being, that being different at different levels within the organisation. Cost is obviously something that comes up again and again within all organisations, whether it's food or in any other sector. Does cost cutting within a food company, does that affect culture?
It would be very easy for me to say yes, wouldn't it? And I'm sure there are a number of incidences where cost cutting has been an influencing factor of where something has gone wrong. But sometimes I feel it's too easy just to blame cost cutting. And what I want to do is I want to give you a scenario or a situation. So let's just say we are visiting a manufacturing plant. And as we're walking around that manufacturing plant, we identify water leaks. Okay?
Okay.
Now, we all know within the food industry, where we've got water and where we've got moisture, we have something called biofilm.
Okay.
Now, if you're not familiar with biofilm, a simple explanation is it actually creates a film that protects bacteria underneath it, and it allows that bacteria to grow.
Okay.
Now, I know some of the facts that we've been hearing during the podcast has talked about Listeria.
Mm.
Listeria pathogen would be one of those bacteria that would be protected and allowed to grow within a biofilm.
And even, you know, I would say, as someone that's not an expert, Listeria growing in a food environment, I'm going to say, is probably not a good thing.
Correct. Correct. And also the biofilm, it allows the listeria to grow. It will then release the listeria.
Okay.
But the main problem is that it's probably going to protect it against cleaning chemicals. So it becomes much more difficult to actually clean.
Okay.
And if we leave it long enough, it becomes very, very difficult. So if we take that scenario and we look at the water leaks, if I go into most sort of manufacturing, they will have what we call GMP inspections, good manufacturing practice inspections, and they will have identified those leaks. And the manager or the maintenance manager is probably aware of those leaks. Now, he may have decided, due to his budget, and he doesn't have enough budget to actually not carry out those repairs of those leaks until the following month or later in the year. Now, you would immediately turn around to me and say, well, that's definitely cost cutting. What I would say is, does that manager understand what biofilms are and how detrimental they are to the food industry? And in that scenario, what we're actually saying here is it a cost-cutting exercise or is it lack of education? And if that maintenance manager had been made aware of the issues, then maybe he would have had all of the leaks repaired. So that's where I'm coming from with regards to sort of cost cutting. But I'm sure you're right. I'm sure people will be able to give you examples of where cost cutting has caused huge problems.
Do you want to find out more about food safety culture and some of the world's leading experts and the UK's best known food brands? Join Tatrain and the University of Sunderland at the inaugural International Food Safety Culture Conference being held at the University of Sunderland. This one-day programme is packed with speakers exploring all aspects of food safety culture. Book now to secure an early bird discount ticket or visit www.tatrain.co.uk/conference to find out more and to book your place. Or details of the conference can be found in the show notes.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were looking in detail at what food safety culture is. John's been doing a great job of explaining what food safety culture is and why it's so important, both in the context of organisations, but also from BRC and how they're looking more closely at people in the food sector and how they're measuring their food safety culture. John, we've talked about whether cost cutting's got an impact on it and really how a food safety culture is born, if you like, and how it can grow within an organisation. I'd like to look more now at a positive culture. What is a positive culture? How would you define that within an organisation?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's a really good question. And it's one of those things that I get asked on a regular basis. There are numerous things that would actually tell me whether we had a positive or a negative culture. But I always say I have five things in the way that I would measure the culture within an organisation. And the first one is fairly simple. And what I sort of say is food safety culture built into the psyche of the company. And what I mean by the psyche of the company is that, you know, is food safety clearly detailed in company policies and procedures? But the more important thing is, do managers and supervisors promote food safety as part of their daily routines?
Okay, so it's something that's ingrained daily.
Exactly.
Okay.
And people are talking about it on a daily basis. And we'll cover that in a little bit later. The other one is the hazard plan. The hazard plan is the cornerstone of any food safety management system, and it identifies the potential risks within that food processing environment. But what I want to know is, how well do individual managers and supervisors understand the hazard plan? A concern I have, and this is when I go into food companies, but also on training courses, is that managers and supervisors don't really have a full understanding of the risks and also the controls that are in place. And what has generally happened is they have been sent on a HACCP course, they've done a generic course, and they have been told the principles of HACCP, but nobody has actually taken them back and gone through the specific hazards and controls within their own manufacturing process. And as an example of this that I find very worrying is, I can go into a company that has actually got an oven as part of their process, a cooking process, should we say, and I'll talk to managers and supervisors, and they do not understand the principle of what a kill step is and what a six log reduction is. And I just think if you're working in that environment and you're managing people, you should have a basic understanding of those things.
So it's people are learning the basics, as you said, and that's a tick box. Yes, they've been HACCP trained. That's fine, sorted. But actually, they're not applying their learning to the environment that they're working in.
I agree totally. And what we have, and each company will be audited at least, well, they'll be audited once from BRC, but they could also get other unannounced audits from different retailers. And then sometimes, exactly what you've just said, it seems to be a tick in the box. Yes, we've all been on HACCP courses, but then how is that translated into day-to-day operations? And, you know, do people clearly understand it? So that would be number two. Number three, and I think this is probably one of the most important ones out of the five, and this is what I say, is that food safety is policed by its own employees. So as a simple example, I'm working on a production line, I'm in a bakery, some product falls off the line, somebody picks it up and they put it back on the line because they don't want wastage, which is great. But from a food safety point of view, it is a disaster. So what I'm expecting is the person stood beside that person says, excuse me, that is unacceptable. What we shouldn't be doing is waiting for a manager or a supervisor to come along and say, stop that. Mainly because managers and supervisors can't be everywhere at the same time.
Absolutely not.
So if we want a really positive food safety culture, it has to be managed by the employees and the people within the culture.
That's interesting, because that links back to what you were saying about the 8-year-olds in the classroom, because children are almost self-regulating to a certain self-policing. Yeah. A couple of them will be naughty, but you have to hope that the other 28 children in the class will police them to a certain extent.
Yes.
And say, no, actually, we'll get into terrible trouble.
We shouldn't do that.
We shouldn't do this.
Yes.
And so exactly, it's that culture that we learn as children that we should be applying in exactly the same way on the food floor.
Yeah. No, I agree. So that then takes me to number four. And number four is having a proactive approach and dealing with issues immediately and not just leaving them. So quite often people are very much focused on targets, production out the door and things like that. But what I'm saying here is having a proactive approach. So if we see issues with regards to food safety culture, whether it's hygiene issues or whatever, then they get resolved straight away. And the other thing that I would like to tie in with that quite strongly is having an open door policy.
Okay.
So allowing people to actually come forward and say, we've got a problem here, I've identified this. And what you can also do is, within that, we can look at the sort of the way that we communicate to individuals. And in most companies, we quite often see things like toolbox talks. The buzzword at the moment is huddles, where at the beginning of the shift we bring everybody together and we talk about certain issues and food safety issues. One of the things I would like to start promoting is, why not have some form of sort of toolbox talks or huddles for senior managers?
Oh, right, okay. So not just for the people working on the floor, for people further up the chain.
Yeah. Yep. So the listeria we've talked about and the biofilms would be a good example. I'm not asking for companies to do half-day sessions or anything like that, but something like half an hour and just going through the key points. And I mean, as another simple example, we could talk about something like pest control. And obviously, you get different pests at different times of the year. So in the springtime, when the spring comes, then you're more likely going to get cockroaches, pigeons are going to be there, and termites. So again, just reminding people and the issues, how you identify them, and then they can communicate that. So I think we don't, in this country, we're not very good at actually giving bite-sized information to senior managers. I think quite often we try to just communicate downwards and cascade it to the sort of the troops on the floor and the employees, and we assume that those people above that already understand it. And my experience is that isn't the case, and I think some companies could benefit greatly from having that sort of half-hour sessions where they inform managers.
And would that help with the agility or flexibility as well? Because presumably in a lot of manufacturing, some of it's seasonal, so a new product may be in place, or they might be moving to meet market shifts and demand and things like that. And actually, when there's change, there's increased risk, presumably.
No, I agree totally. I mean, that's a perfect example, isn't it, is where we bring in one new product which might have a totally different set of risks than what we were actually familiar with other products. So it's communicating that, but not on the day that we introduce the actual product. It's trying to do it, you know, beforehand. But yeah, no, that would be another one. And then the final one is, without any doubt, is rewarding good safety practice. And this goes back to values, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And how many companies do I go into that we've got a great appraisal systems, we've got a full set of key performance indicators, KPIs, and within that appraisal, people have set their own KPIs and their own targets, and they're all about volume, sales targets, and things like that. How many companies actually reward good food sort of principles and practices that are actually happening out there? So I think we don't do enough. And I think there's two levels here, isn't there? There's the formal rewarding people through the appraisal system, but then there's the day-to-day, managers and supervisors rewarding people as well on a daily basis.
And what sort of ways could we do that? How could we encourage that, but also how would that look in practice?
One of the areas that I would say is, we've already mentioned huddles, and what they are is primarily at the beginning of the shift, we bring people together and we talk about what we're going to do. And what people are now introducing is sort of bad practices that they saw yesterday, customer complaints. That would be a perfect opportunity also to then sort of reward somebody and sort of tell everybody, you know, some of the good things that they've seen in the sort of the environment during the last day or what have you. So I think during huddles, but I think just generally walking around, when we see good practice, we should go to the operator and we should tell them, rather than, you know, a lot of operators I go to say the only time anybody talks to me is when something's gone wrong.
So we've talked about defining a positive culture within an organisation, and we've heard a lot about what a negative culture might look like and what a positive culture might look like. And we've talked about some ways of helping to improve the culture. But how does a company evaluate and improve its food safety culture?
Yes. How do they evaluate and improve? We could do a whole podcast on this, couldn't we?
I'll bet. I'm guessing that that's the golden question, isn't it? And if people knew that exactly,
it is.
We wouldn't have to be here talking about it.
No. So what I would like to do is, I'm going to just go over and give people an overview, really, of the type of things that we should be doing. We started off this podcast and we talked about informal and formal culture, which includes employees, management and supervisors. The first thing we have to do is engage.
Okay.
We have to engage with people and find out what they are thinking, what is inside their heads, what are their values, what are they expecting. So that is the first thing. How can we engage? And The common way, and certainly the guidance provided by BRC, is they have listed a number of different things. So the first one is creating a sort of a food safety culture questionnaire.
Okay.
Which I think you've already mentioned, Dawn, is that as part of To Train and the University of Sunderland, we've created what we call the 4Cs model, which would allow food manufacturers to analyse their food safety culture and then implement an improvement programme. So what we've done is we've created this questionnaire. It's split into the 4Cs. So we look at control, how you control your sort of environment, cooperation, so how do people cooperate with each other, communication, and competency.
Okay.
And there's a number of questions. So you issue that out. Now, there are a few things that we need to think about is, if we employ 500 people, how many do we need to issue out to get a represented sample? So there's sort of statistics that will tell you that. Quite often when we go into food companies, we've got different languages or people speaking different languages. So do we need to have the questionnaire in different languages? Anyway, we circulate it electronically or hard copy, and then we get the information back and we analyse it. The problem with that is when we get the information back, we now need to validate that information. So the next stage, without any doubt, people do what we call one-to-one interviews.
Okay.
Where they will take some of the key points that have been raised within the culture questionnaire, and they will go and interview people and try and find evidence of that, whether it's good or bad. Following on from that, once we've done the one-to-ones, we will probably come up with a number of different topics that we feel that we need to sort of look at and investigate further. So the next one is focus groups and bringing people together to actually discuss these issues, discuss why we've got a problem, what can we do to put them right, and basically coming forward with an action plan. And then by doing the different focus groups, we can then bring that information together and create an action plan, which is one of the key requirements of the Global Standard for Food Safety, Issue 8, or the BRC standard. And then from there, we can then start, hopefully, improving our culture. So those are the main areas: questionnaire, one-to-one interviews, focus groups, and then generating a plan. This should be seen as an ongoing process. And in reality, BRC have actually said that, you know, if you've got a food safety culture plan, that, you know, these things don't get changed quickly, and it could be 3 to 5 years, that plan. So again, we're not looking for quick hits. And the other one I would always advise companies is this: we're not looking for large of numbers of things that we're going to change. We would prefer to see 3 or 4 things done very well than 20 things done badly. So that really, in a nutshell and very quickly, takes you through the steps an organisation could take to improve their food safety culture.
If you'd like to learn more about food safety culture, the Enlightened 4Cs Food Safety Culture Model, and how to undertake a food safety improvement programme, come and meet John and join us at the International Food Safety Culture Conference on September the 4th at Sunderland University. For details of who we'll be presenting and how to book your place, go to www.totrain.co.uk/conference, or you can email Alison at alison@totrain.co.uk.
What sort of themes have come out from the work that you've done so far? Where do you find that organisations are finding the issues, and then how are they putting that right?
It's various, and I think it's difficult depending on the different sizes of companies. But I would say, without doubt, one of the main areas that comes out is induction process.
Okay.
And how we actually feed people into the process, and especially large companies that have a high turnover of staff, possibly using agency or temporary staff, then that becomes quite a problem. And you can imagine if you're working in a company and we're coming around to Christmas time, we employ 500, but that's going to go up to 950. Managing them is very difficult. So again, looking at things like that. The one thing that we haven't said is when you do a food safety culture, quite often it will raise issues on things like communication. I'll guarantee if you've got a problem in communication, it isn't just food safety culture. It'll be operational, it'll be production and everything else. So that's one of the things that you're going to need to look at. But I would say quite often communication then becomes one of the other big issues. So quite often those are two big issues that we see on a sort of fairly regular basis.
So setting that foundation stone right from the beginning, and then making sure that you keep talking to your all of your employees,
yeah,
and making that a two-way process.
Yeah.
Those are the two key things.
It does. And I think the other thing that we need to think about that, and I know you're going to have Dr. Derek Watson on one of the future podcasts, and he gives a great example of somebody coming into your company. It could be two things. It could be a brand new suitcase that has no dents or whatever blemishes, or it could be one that's been around the world four times. So are people bringing their own culture and values, and especially when we're employing people from different parts of the world? So the induction site isn't just about the culture being imposed internally, it could be the culture that you're introducing into your system. So, you know, that side as well would probably be need to look at in some companies.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. I've learned lots and lots. I've been slightly scared by some of what you've said, but it's reassuring to know that food safety culture has been looked at more carefully by BRC and hopefully by food companies around the country.
No, I agree. And I would say it is the holy grail. It's the missing link. It's what we've needed for a long time. So thank you. No, I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to our first edition of Food Safety, The Facts. In our next interview, we'll take a close look at the 4Cs culture model, which John spoke about and which has been developed by Tutrain and Dr. Derek Watson of the University of Sunderland Research Programme. Join us then. The great food safety tool we're giving away is 1 month's free access to the online 4Cs culture model application developed by Tutrain and the University of Sunderland. To access your 1 month's free trial, drop Alison an email at alison@tutrain.co.uk. That's Alison with one L. Details of the 4Cs culture model and Alison's contact details are given in the show notes. This podcast was brought to you by Tutrain and featured John Husband and Peter Henry from Tutrain. It was directed and produced by Bethany Duncan and featured me, Don Schaefer, asking the questions. Join us next time for more on food safety culture. Thanks for listening.